first case, which is 20-2332, Latin American Music Company, Inc. v. Spanish Broadcasting System. Do we have counsel present? Please come up. Good morning. And Mr. Storch?
Yes.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think the seminal event in the proceeding below that directly led to the assessment of nearly a $1 million fee assessment against the plaintiff happened approximately 30 minutes before the trial began, the trial on the actual merits. And that is when the plaintiff's attorney had disclosed to the court on the other side that audio tapes recorded the infringing works did in fact exist, contrary to that attorney's representation a few weeks earlier that they had been destroyed in some sort of ransomware attack. And I understand Judge Sullivan was understandably outraged. That is not the way it's supposed to work in federal court. Those tapes have been requested some 2-3 years earlier. But the failure to produce those, and I think the record below is clear, was not due to the plaintiff or to Mr. Bernard. The evidence below showed that on its initial disclosures, which were filed within a few weeks or months when the action was actually started, the initial disclosures indicated that these tapes existed. And they were listed as likely evidence in the case. The attorney for Mr. Bernard at that time, Mr. Flores, testified, and was unequivocal in his testimony, that Mr. Bernard, plaintiff, had turned the tapes over to him, that he had the tapes. And he said that he had gotten ill, he had neglected to turn them over in the initial production, and when his illness progressed, he turned them over to subsequent counsel, Mr. Talcott.
Right. But why does this, let me ask you this, the defendant has gotten an award of attorney's fees based upon all of these activities that occurred, and why shouldn't he get his attorney's fees, notwithstanding whatever happened with regard to these tapes? They weren't produced, and it was just part of a series of if you want to look at it charitably, mishaps. It sounds to me like there was blame to go around on the part of everybody on the plaintiff's side. How should this affect the award of attorney's fees?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it should affect it in the sense of how are you going to assess those penalties? Who was actually responsible for that? This is a crushing.
Well, ultimately, the attorney works for the party, and the party is responsible, isn't it? Isn't that the case?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, because the award of fees is discretionary, I think the court has the power to decide whether or not they're going to have the full burden
So you think that in one of these cases because the award of fees is discretionary, if the district court thinks it's the lawyer's fault more than specifically the client's fault, the district court shouldn't award fees?
The question, Your Honor, is how do you allocate those fees? Do you have that fall entirely on the head of the client? And I think here,
but that's a weird thing to suggest that the district court is supposed to apportion fault between the client and the attorney. I mean, shouldn't that be resolved by some kind of a malpractice action between the client and the attorney? Why should the district court be looking behind the representation of the client to decide whether it was the client's fault or the attorney's fault and in what proportion? I mean, that seems like an extraordinary thing for the district court to do, doesn't it?
In the other circumstances, yes, that's what the district court actually did here. The district court actually convened a subsequent hearing and had both the attorneys testify And the subject of that hearing was to find out what had happened with respect to why were these tapes not disclosed. And it was during that hearing that the district court conducted that it became very clear that the client had, in fact, turned these tapes over, and that the client hadn't even realized until some few days before the trial that the attorneys had not turned them over to the other
side. Well, can I ask you this? So if, in fact, let's put aside the question of fault on the part of the attorney and on the part of the client. If we just said that your side failed to produce the tapes, and also, by the way, even though you have the sub-publishing agreement, failed to point to set paragraph one that seems to have the exclusive license, you failed to put forward all of this evidence, would that justify an award of attorney's fees because you didn't bring to the district court's attention the evidence in support of your claim? Putting aside whether it should be apportioned between the how it should be apportioned between the client and the attorney, it seems like you're not disputing that that justifies an award of attorney's fees.
No, I think what we're arguing here is that the fees, in the discretion of the court, which the court should consider whether or not those should be allocated across the response to the parties.
So, counsel,
but he did consider it. He didn't agree with you, but he considered it. That was the argument that was made before below.
Sure.
No, he exercised his discretion, didn't he?
Your Honor, I think the record supports that actually the court had determined it was not an allocator. In fact, in the record, this is at the end of the trial, before there was a hearing, even on this issue of fees, A681, the district court indicated that in its determination that the plaintiff was going to be held accountable for this, regardless of what had happened.
But the argument was made to the court, to the district judge, that the attorney's fees should be shared between the lawyer and the client, right?
Correct.
So he heard it and he considered it and he disagreed. That happens all the time.
No question about it. I think in this case, Your Honor, I think it's clear from the statements of the district court.
The fact that he ultimately concluded that the lawyers, that he wasn't going to award fees against the lawyers, just as a consequence of his consideration and an exercise of his discretion, right?
Your Honor, we would submit that as an abuse of discretion, there was a failure on the district court to evaluate this evidence without apportionment.
What about Judge Menasche's point that this can all be sorted out later on between the client and the attorney? If in fact the attorney behaved in such a way that was negligence or malpractice, fell below professional standards, don't you have a claim against? Does the client have a claim against him?
Well, there are practical considerations. This is Torres versus
this is what.
Practical considerations. Mr. Torres had to withdraw because of illness, I believe, although I would have to double-check the record. The statute of limitations would have run on that against his representation.
Well, but we're not going to change the way we would evaluate this case based on your failure to act before the expiration of the statute of limitations. I mean, can you just explain to me why, if we think that there is a remedy in the form of a malpractice suit against your attorney, whether you took advantage of it or not, why isn't that the way fees should be apportioned between a client and an attorney?
Because there was here what even with the defendants in this case called the fraud on the court, in which the district court came extremely close to saying this is in fact a fraud on the court. And I think the district court has the inherent power when something like that happens before it to bring before it all the responsible parties and to make a determination as to who and in what proportion should be responsible for it.
And am I correct? I think you've said it a number of times, but the statute, the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, right?
That's correct, right?
And that's rather deferential, right?
It is rather deferential, no question. I think that...
Well, wait a minute ago. Now you're saying you think that the judge should have had everybody come before him to reach a determination. But a minute ago, I thought you indicated that he did exactly that.
He did, but I don't believe that this record supports that the judge was doing that with an idea of allocating amongst the various people who may be caused an additional cost. to the defendants. I think, to come back, I understand Your Honor's point that you select your attorney and to a great extent you're stuck with that. But here you have a situation in federal court where you had conduct that even the district court was tantamount to fraud by the attorneys. I mean, a client turns over documents to his attorneys. As the attorney, there's nothing in this record to suggest after they were turned over that the attorney said, hey, you know, we haven't produced this document, you know, better give it to us. There's nothing to suggest that the client had any reason to believe, other than that when he turned over to the attorney, they were doing what they were supposed to.
So, Mr. Storch, let me just say, I think you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I did, yes.
Would you like to use any of that time now, or would you rather save that for rebuttal?
If anyone has questions, I'll answer them now, otherwise I'll save them.
Why don't we move along to opposing counsel, and then we'll come back to you. Thank you, Mr. Storch. Mr. Cimitaro?
Yes. Thank you. May it please the Court. James Cimitaro on behalf of Brian Cashman and SDS. I think that we need to take one step back and just center this issue, which is my adversary said, well, the seminal issue occurred with the recordings at the 11th hour. That's actually not true at all. The recordings are just one of three pieces of critical evidence that were contributed in this case. It was the recordings, and I reviewed them in 1 second. The Excel spreadsheet, which is essentially the annotation for recordings that allegedly documented the who, the what, the when. And then the transfer document, which we discovered on the eve of trial by going through a separate document. That transfer document is pivotal, because that transfer document revealed that there was a serious issue with standing. So,
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry, I'll speak up.
It revealed what?
The transfer document revealed that there were considerable issues regarding the appellate's standing to bring the claim.
Yeah.
So the judge saw that had already granted summary judgment in this case, finding that 7 of the 13 works were clearly time-barred in the fact that the appellants were not the owners of those works. The other 6, we didn't have the opportunity to conduct the
summary. Can you help me evaluate this? So, it seems that they failed to bring to the district court's attention the evidence showing that they are the owners or would have a claim, a copyright claim. But as they point out, the sub-publishing agreement in paragraph 1 gives them an exclusive license, even given the fact that the rights were transferred. There's an exclusive license back. And generally, you have a cause of action under the Copyright Act if you're an exclusive licensee. So if the standard here is the objective reasonableness of the claim, let's say, and maybe you'll dispute the facts, but let's say for the purposes of this question, there are facts supporting their claim. Let's say they had an exclusive license. Let's say that the recordings existed and they could show it. Let's say it all happened, but they somehow failed to present it to the district court through what Judge Walker said was a series of mishaps or maybe something more nefarious. I don't know. Should we consider that objectively unreasonable if, in fact, they had a valid claim, they just presented it improperly or inadequately?
Two parts in the response to that. I think the first part, Your Honor, is Judge Sullivan is looking toward rules upon the evidence that's put in front of him. And the testimony that was put in front of him, including by a very sophisticated plaintiff who brings multiple copyright infringement actions, was referred to the wrong provision in the paragraph. So the judge is supposed to consider what's in front of him. It's not his obligation to definitively get through and read other provisions that were either not brought to his attention or which were brought to his attention in a different paragraph. That's the first part. But the second part, which I think is critical, is there's a leap of faith here that the plaintiffs don't deserve the benefit of, which is that standing document demonstrated that Lenko, the appellate, transferred their entire catalog, 40,000 works according to them, to his sister-in-law for zero consideration, and then allegedly got it back. We believe it was for to project conveyance to get around creditors and their other bankruptcy. But we didn't get enough any discovery because we found that document proactively. So it wasn't produced despite being asked for it multiple times in discovery on our own on the verge of trial. So the suggestion that, well, I have this document and one paragraph of this document gives me standing when we know for the first 7 songs they already had summary judgment against them, I don't think they're entitled to that presumption that they actually do have standing. We don't know. Everything's an open question at best. But what we do know is when they filed this action, 7 of the 13 songs they did not have standing for. And that was prevailed on in summary judgment.
So, in fact, if they had pointed to paragraph 1 and said they were an exclusive licensee rather than claiming they were the owner of the copyright, you would have said that that was invalid because the whole thing was part of a fraudulent conveyance scheme, and then we would have had an argument about that, or the district court would have.
To be fair, Your Honor, we would have had multiple arguments that we may have found that we can present to enough discovery. I would say that the circumstances surrounding that $0 transfer to your sister-in-law certainly raise questions. I really don't know what defenses may have arisen because, again, we never got there. But again, that's just one of two parts.
And am I right that there was never really a discussion of paragraph one, that they were all focused on paragraph eight about the non-exclusive right to enforce?
I do believe that's correct. I believe the focus was primarily not on paragraph number one. It was not really about the judge's
intention. It does show that the lawyer did not seem to be doing an effective job.
Well, I'd also say that the CEO and president of the plaintiff, who has brought multiple copyright infringement actions, who was part of this agreement, part of this agreement, also lived in the document. And I think that's critical because direct testimony in this case was submitted by affidavit and declaration. So he didn't even mention this kind of document. He was trying to hide it. He was trying to hide it for a variety of reasons, which we don't know exactly why. But I don't think we should give him the benefit of saying, you hit it, you know, it's a knock.
Although I read the I mean, and when it comes out in the testimony, I assume it's in your cross-examination of him, and you say, what about this transfer document? He says, oh, yes, well, you know, his company is the original owner, and then they transferred it to this woman, but then they got a license back. So he didn't say that on cross-examination, right?
On cross-examination, when he was finally forced to answer this document, he gave testimony which Judge Sullivan, and I quote, said it was incredible, self-contradictory, implausible.
And why was it self-contradictory? Because he originally claimed to be the owner of it and then claimed to have a license back, and then they never really pointed to the source of the license.
That's correct. Yeah. He also couldn't explain the circumstances of why you transferred 40,000 alleged works for $1. And the timing also didn't make sense because it was an initial bankruptcy, and that transfer document wasn't very clear as to when it came back. There was no clear path as to when the transfer started and when it came back. And if I may, when I said that we shouldn't give them this leap of faith as to whether they have standing, I also don't think there's something to the benefit that should give to them that these recordings allegedly came anything. Because it almost like a parking trial. We're dealing with a briefcase, and we don't know what's in the briefcase. Because what's important to remember, and you just heard my adversary state this, which is from the inception of this case, in our initial disclosures, we identified the recordings. Well, if you look at the history of this case, there was 3 minutes to the complaint, and the songs changed over time. Where were the other recordings? How come the initial disclosures were not updated? Because there's only 6 songs at the beginning. There's 13 by the operative complaint.
But does it matter whether the recordings existed or did not exist, or is it enough that they said they had them, and they didn't have them, and they failed to produce them?
Well, I think it's certainly enough. You have a litigation misconduct here, and that's undeniable. But I also think that what we're trying to say is that it wasn't objectively reasonable because we had this evidence. But to this day, we don't know what that evidence was. All we have is unidentified recordings.
Right, so that was my question about if we assume the evidence exists but they failed to put it in front of the district court, does that make a difference? Should we say it's objectionably reasonable on the assumption that it exists? And I think your answer was the district court has to decide based on what's put in front of the district court, and so it doesn't matter.
Well, I think it's two parts, and I hope I'm answering your question. On the first part, I'd say we have a litigation misconduct. You didn't produce pivotal evidence. That alone is in and of itself. But what I'm saying is, on top of that, if in fact these are phantom recordings, if in fact these recordings don't have any evidence, it certainly gets to the fact that there may have been another motivation, which is another factor to consider under this highly deferential standard. And
yeah,
I also think it's important to know.
I have a question about the, I think at the, just after it was revealed that in fact there were the recordings at the very, on the eve of trial, I guess it was, or maybe it was even during trial, I don't know. But the last iteration of this saga, the plaintiff said, we have the recordings now. We didn't think we had them before. We now have them, but we're not going to rely on them. What was that all about?
We actually filed a motion of limine, not on the 11th hour, I'd say about 2 months before the trial day, according to the pre-trial calendar, where we said, here are the 4 or 5 things that we felt we never produced in this case. And one of them was the recordings. So this notion that the appellant's CEO, president, was shocked because he found out the morning of the hearing It's actually not correct. He knew that the recordings were going to be out at the time that he submitted his direct testimony, which he never submitted by declaration.
So they were just letting the district court know that they existed, but that in compliance with the motion and the order on the motion in limine, they were not going to introduce them.
Okay. Honestly, Your Honor, the entire thing was a head scratcher, and we have been talking about this.
They didn't specify that that was the reason. They just said, we're not going to rely on
it. Well, they did, so they're already out. They're out before.
So even if they wanted to rely on them, they would have had to ask the district court to reconsider its earlier order if they wanted to.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And what we've heard, at least in the papers, is that Mr. Talcott, and it's easy to point fingers on the top of the room, he's not here to defend himself, and there have been a lot of arrows that have thrown at him, but that he was so conflicted that he couldn't do his job. He kind of asked for a stay a month before the trial because of their bankruptcy, their firm claims. Judge Sullivan denied it. They could have at least asked for a stay or some other remedial measure. Instead, what they're asking this court, Your Honor, you asked the right question, is this kind of a remedy? Your remedy is a malpractice claim. What they're asking this court, this Spanish broadcasting system, to be the guarantor of their choice of counsel. They threw up Mr. Talcott's ass. They elected to hire him.
Well, I don't know if they're really asking that. I mean, would it really affect you if the fees were split between them and their counsel somehow?
And out of respect, why is it my burden? My burden under Section 505, the court has discretion to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. We're the prevailing party, there's no question about that. If the appellants don't like the attorney's fees, then they have the remedy. They could go out and they could sue their counsel. But it also not to be overruled.
But what's the harm to your client? It would just be the delay in having a procedure for apportioning the damages and getting the fees, but it wouldn't actually reduce the fees to which you're entitled.
Well, it also, correct, it would be delayed. I would point this court to a 2015 decision from this court in Casaduce, 16 Casaduce, where the courts have said, well, at most, the plaintiffs and their attorneys are going to be jointly and separately liable. So if they were going to be jointly liable, that's a separate hearing which doesn't follow us, which is kind of what Judge Sullivan did do. So it is important to know, you heard about the Showcause briefing. That Showcause briefing was separate and apart from the attorney's briefing. And that Showcause briefing was not for the purposes of assessing just fault or whether or not this case should be referred to the Attorney General for perjury. If you read the end of the trial transcript, it is a fighting 6 minutes where Judge Sullivan used words that would surpass any objectively unreasonable standard. When he said, this is not close to a close call, and I am deeply troubled by what happened in this courtroom. He did consider not just the appellant's misconduct, but all the appellant's misconduct, and ultimately decided that the blame lays with the appellants. And he did consider the dual interest of the copyright statute. And one of them is to deter frivolous lawsuits. And these appellants have filed frivolous lawsuit after frivolous lawsuit, and they actually filed for bankruptcy to avoid attorney's fees that were awarded against them for the prior frivolous lawsuits. They need to deter. This is a serial litigant who files actions without evidence of infringement, without evidence of standing or ownership. And this is just the latest time. SPS decided upon themselves that they're tired of getting baseless cease and desist letters. So they took them out of the trial, and they prevailed, and there should be consequences for that. And those consequences were an award of attorney's fees against the appellants, not their attorneys, against the appellants.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Storch, you've reserved 3 minutes.
Yes. Again, I go back to, the question of the allocation's fault. And as counsel has indicated, there was a separate. But the district court declined to do was in listening to the evidence of that hearing, making determinations whether it was fair and equitable to have this fall on the shoulders. And on one thing, I hear about the case again, if I could.
So I'm sorry, you just said he declined to make, I thought it's what we're fighting about here is that he did make the allocation and he put it all on the plaintiff's shoulders.
He put it all on the plaintiff's shoulders.
So it's not that he failed to allocate it, he just didn't allocate it the way you think it ought to have been allocated.
I think that the judge declined to make any allocation, and I think that's contrary to the record.
So you think he was either unaware or unwilling to even consider whether any of the fees should be assessed against the attorneys.
I do. And I think if you look at the record, John, and again, I said at the outset of this, I understand why Judge Sullivan was incensed. It's not the way it's supposed to happen in the court, right? But at the beginning, before Mr. Bernard even took the stand, the judge said Mr. Bernard is walking into a very dangerous, dangerous cross-examination, and there's going to be health dangerous. It was clear that the judge had determined that this was Mr. Bernard's fault.
Or he could see what was coming.
Pardon?
Or he could see what was coming because it was entirely apparent, and he was giving your client fair warning. Right? That's an alternate version of viewing it, right?
It is, but I think
which is somehow sometimes could be viewed as a kindness to a client to give them warning of how to avoid engaging in misconduct that's sanctionable. So it could be viewed as a kindness on the part of the district judge that was simply ignored by the client, right? That's another way of viewing it.
That's interpretation. I don't think the record actually bears that out.
Well, wasn't that statement a reference to the fact that all of the evidence of infringement was going to be that one person's testimony because the recordings weren't available, and so therefore the district court, I recall, emphasized that he needs to have superhuman powers of recall or something to that effect in order to carry his burden? I mean, that's what he's referring to. I mean, do you dispute that? I mean, if in fact all the evidence of infringement relied on his testimony, he was in fact walking into something that was going to be very crucial.
Well, and I do agree, Your Honor, that that's superhuman recall. And the problem was that Mr. Bernard walked into the trial, in preparation for the trial, with an understanding, and I think it was a perfectly reasonable understanding, to be able to refer to the contemporaneous reporters.
Well, wait a minute. I thought we just heard from counsel, and I thought it was undisputed that the district court, months before trial, had granted a motion in limine saying if there are any recordings that are later produced, they are excluded. So I guess I'm not sure what you mean by your client walked into trial expecting there to be recordings.
In the record, Your Honor, Mr. Bernard testified that within 2 weeks of the trial, as he was coming up to prepare for the case, he was told for the first time that the recordings were not going to be.
Okay, but that's still 2 weeks before trial. You're saying he learned of the motion of limine well before the trial.
I'd say 2 weeks, you know.
Okay. All right.
Again, it sounds like you're not disputing that given what actually transpired at the trial, your client's claims were objectively unreasonable.
No, I think the findings as to why they were objectionably unreasonable, for instance, that there's no evidence of infringement. You could say, yes, they're objectionably unreasonable because there was no testimony, but there was no testimony because the tapes weren't permitted to be in. You could say, oh, it's objectionably unreasonable. They couldn't testify from the tapes.
So I guess that's kind of my question, which I put to the opposing counsel, which is, if the evidence exists out there, but you fail to put it in front of the district court, does that make your claim objectively reasonable? Because it exists, just that you didn't present it properly?
I think from the client's standpoint, yes. From the client's standpoint, I have this evidence. I believe I have objectively basis for bringing a claim. This is what I understand my evidence is. This is what I understand is going to be put before the court. You're looking now into, you know, the mind of the client. From the client's standpoint, he thinks I've got these tapes. He even testifies at the trial that he believes he still has standing to bring the action, notwithstanding the assignment to Dolores Vera.
And Judge Sullivan found your client's testimony incredible, right?
Right.
Right. And he's the finder of fact, right? And we have to affirm findings of fact unless they're clearly erroneous, right?
Okay.
If you have one last thing just to wrap up?
Sure. I just want to point out that with respect to any allegation that he was defaulting the tapes, Mr. Bernard knew it. He appeared, was ready to appear for his deposition in Miami, Florida. He testified, I was coming with copies of the tapes from my deposition from the computer. And then the defendants canceled the deposition. They never took his deposition.
Okay. I think we have your argument. Thank you very much to both counsel. We will take that case under advisement.
Thank you.